Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast. I'm Lee.
And I'm Simon.
And we're happy you could join us again. We apologise, it's been a couple of weeks. Well, it's been more than a couple of weeks now since the last episode. But Simon was off having a jolly last week. That's basically it, really. He stood me up, so I couldn't record anything.
Well, I've done it before and you managed to survive. You just get someone else on.
Yeah, I thought about doing that originally, but then a lot of people suggested having Mark McKinnon on. But I thought, well, all that's going to happen there, if we do that, it's just going to end up into... It's going to just finish in a big fight, and we're going to just be attacking each other the whole time. And I would say, who wants to listen to that? But judging by the reaction on Twitter, quite a lot of people.
I just wonder how many times Forensic Tool would be mentioned if you had Mark McKinnon on again.
Why do you do that? You know that I'm the one who's going to take responsibility for those kinds of comments.
I'm just saying that the amount of times it almost seems to have to be mentioned in every podcast the way it's been going recently.
Yes, thank you very much. anything interesting been happening with you recently, Simon, apart from your little vacation holiday last week?
What's been going on recently? Got a new car. That was nice.
Very nice. Yes. I'm still driving the piece of crap which we have. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Whereas we got a nice fancy car with some gadgets on.
Yeah. As a side note, Simon is scared of crabs.
Only slightly.
Do you want to tell us the story?
Last week we went to a seaside town, essentially, on holiday in the UK. Lisa's family all live in that area, and one of the things we did during the week was we went crabbing, which involved essentially getting string, attaching some kind of food that crabs are drawn to, waiting for them to cling onto the food, and then kind of pulling them out of the water on this string. It took, on a couple of occasions, a 7-year-old girl to pick up a couple of these crabs that came off a piece of string. I wish to point out, though, that this 7-year-old girl is fearless and she will do anything. I guess I was just scared of them pinching me, really.
How big were these crabs, Simon?
They weren't the biggest. The largest one was possibly smaller than the average adult fist.
And how small were some of the others?
I'd have picked up the smaller ones. This only happened with the larger one.
Yeah, the small one's about the size of a quarter or something, yeah?
Possibly. But I wasn't scared of those ones. I just see to point that out.
Well, I could just see you standing in the water on your tiptoes going, oh no, they're going to get me. And then the tiny, tiny little crabs that fit in the palm of your hand.
I think you're taking it too far.
And then the 7-year-old girl walking up and going, don't worry, Simon, I'll save you.
Shut up, I drive a nicer car than you.
Yeah, thanks, shut up. All right, enough of this. You see, this probably would have happened if Mark McKinnon was on anyway. All right, so on to some interesting news. Well, first of all, Lee Reber is going to be on doing an interview for us further into the podcast, so keep an eye out for that. And I think there's not really anything else. We're still trying to figure out a new little project which we're putting together, which concerns digital forensic videos, and hopefully we'll be able to make an announcement about that next time we record. I was interviewed by Larry Daniel, a bit of quid pro quo there, on Talk Forensics a couple of weeks ago. If you want to listen to that, you can toddle over to www.blogtalkradio.com/talkforensics, and I was the interview from the 30th of August. So have a little listen to that and see what you think. So, yeah. Anyway, Moving swiftly on, Simon. Anything you'd like to talk about this week?
Okay, something that has cropped up in the past week and a half really is ACPO have unveiled an e-crime strategy, and ACPO, as I'm sure we've mentioned before, is the Association of Chief Police Officers for England.
Easy for
and
you
Wales.
To say.
Well, apparently not. But they essentially watch over and look after the police forces around England and Wales and Northern Ireland. There's obviously a very similar one, ACPOS, responsible for Scotland. But together they've come up with this e-crime strategy, which on initial glances looks like it could be quite interesting. They've essentially deemed that e-crime is possibly not being paid as much attention to as it could be by law enforcement in this country, which is good of them to notice. And of course, that's going to be the case with the fact that it's rising year on year, and we've got still a number of police officers who aren't necessarily to grips with modern technology and the use of computers, the internet, or whatever else. So there's always going to be a gap there between the tracking of crime and the dealing with e-crime. So they've noticed this and they've decided they're going to do something about it. So they've come up with this strategy, and they've essentially said there needs to be better regulation in regards to e-crime, and they have several priorities that they've put in place. These are to upgrade computer forensics to target e-crime resources and cut forces forensic backlog, to improve the accuracy of e-crime recording, to raise police understanding of e-crime and improve frontline officers' skills, to improve capacity to investigate e-crimes and coordinate police responses across the country. That's essentially the bulk of it, and also to educate the public on how to protect themselves against e-crime.
Well, that's quite impressive. So they're doing quite a lot of different things there to try and raise awareness and to more effectively investigate these things.
Yeah, they're certainly very good goals and things that that need to be applauded as things that they're actually trying to implement throughout police forces throughout the country.
Well, so that must mean that they're willing to pour in a significant amount of money in order to reach these objectives.
The Police National E-Crime Unit currently has a budget of £7.4 million slash until 2011.
Right.
Yeah. So they've got a lot of work to do. And hopefully they have plans in mind to attract other funding or to do something else, because I don't think 7.4 million until 2011 is enough to educate the public on e-crime, let alone do the rest of the things they want to do.
Yeah, so we're talking around about, I mean, I know we're nearly at the end of 2009, but we're talking around about £3.7 million a year in order for them to exist as they currently exist, and then make all these improvements and advances which you said they were proposing.
Yes.
And they're just the immediate priorities. They're not.
Yeah, these don't include all the slightly lower down the scale priorities. These are the top dog kind of priorities, the ones they're really gonna go at. I think they're all really good things to try and do, but I think there's some amount of underestimating the size of the task ahead for the majority of these bullet points, really.
Yeah. I think, though, when you look at the article's from computerweekly.com, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you look at the article, it says the other main task was to get buy-in from industry, the police, and the rest of the criminal justice sector. So if they can get buy-in from industry and from the police and from the rest of the criminal justice sector,
they'll be fine.
Then they should be all right. But if they're left to hang out by themselves, that £7.4 million is going to get sucked up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider new advances in technology, you know, increased server storage and all kinds of stuff, you know, training requirements, salaries and, you know, no bribes. No, I'm kidding.
What?
That was a joke. But that money can go very, very quickly.
Yeah. You look at the bottom, you know, the second half of the top bullet point, to cut Force's forensic backlog. That alone is quite a task. Some police forces are starting to mount up considerable backlogs for forensic work.
Yeah. Well, I know what they should do there. Instead of giving it, you know, to these guys, because they've obviously got a limited budget, just give it to us. We'll do it. And, you know, we don't charge very much, so we'll get it done cheap. And, well, you know, it'll be a good job, and we'll send it back, and everything will be fine.
Yep.
So there you go, no more backlog. So all you police forces out there in the UK with backlog, just call Zentech, send it our way, we'll be fine. Oh, dear. It's going to be another one of those episodes, isn't it? It already is. Yeah, so anything else you wanted to say about this ACPO business?
I just really hope it works. I think it's quite a task, and I certainly wouldn't want to be responsible for trying to pull off any of these. But I wish them the best luck in the world to get it done, because it can only be good news if these things work.
I mean, you look at some of the stuff which they've been able to do previously, and the most notable thing they've been able to do is they've taken down hundreds of websites that sold fraudulent or unlicensed tickets to British football soccer matches. And they've, you know, broken up a couple of gangs that have been set up to steal and sell customers' bank account details. So they've had some effect, but you really have to wonder how much effect they can have. I mean, like you said, it'd be something that would really be good to work, but that's not enough.
It possibly needs more than an initiative, doesn't it? It needs pretty much a countrywide change in the way that the police generally look at crime for it to really work in the way that you'd hope it would. And that's quite a task.
Well, the thing is, I mean, we've had this conversation before at work, but you think about all the crime that goes on in the world, and crime, you know, it's everywhere, but it's so easy to commit a crime when you're sitting at home in the comfort of your own home with your computer, and you think, oh, you know, no one's going to care if I do this. You know, even just downloading a song or something like that. E-crime is prevalent throughout. And you're right, it's going to require a change in the mentality of how these things are dealt with, just on a national basis, I think. So, but, yeah, fun stuff. We'll wait and see how that develops, and I'm sure we'll hear more as time goes on. Or, well, you never know. They might do what all other government-funded agencies do and either just completely cease to exist or be renamed and rebranded and sold on as something else. So, yeah, who knows? Right. Well, one of the big pieces of news over the last couple of weeks was this court ruling involving the Major League Baseball players and electronic searches. This the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Ninth Council rejected arguments by the U.S. Justice Department that it be allowed to retain and use all of the data that it seized in 2004 as part of a federal investigation into the use of illegal substances use by Major League Baseball players. So, effectively, what's happened here is that there's been a raid and computers were seized. These computers contain information about different baseball players, like drug tests and stuff like that. Now, what happened is that they went through, they were allowed to target specific players, but they weren't granted the ability to look at other players. Like, the warrant covered basically, I think, three players, and there was more than three players on there. So they've gone out and they've said, right, well, we've got these three players. Now all these other players that are on this computer, this is plain sight, meaning that, you know, we've seen it during the course of our investigation, so we're just going to use that information to prosecute the others. But that's not the case, is it? What's happened, Simon?
Well, they've kind of overstepped the mark in what they were doing, really. And the judge has decided that the plain sight rule shouldn't apply to this or other similar circumstances. Plain view, he doesn't think should really apply to electronic searches in general.
Yeah. Well, what is plain view, Simon? Well, if something's in plain view or plain sight, what does that mean?
Plain view, I guess it's meant for a situation when a warrant is to be executed somewhere, and you attend a premises or whatever, and the things that are specifically listed in the warrant are outnumbered essentially by the things that you happen to see when you when you enter this premises. So if you're going on a drugs raid or something like that, and you have a warrant that applies to a series of cannabis plants or something and nothing else, and you go in and you see dotted around other drugs or material for producing these drugs, then because that's in plain view, you can essentially seize that at the same time, and that can become part of the investigation.
So, in terms of computers, what we're talking about here is, say you've got a fraud examination, and you go in, you're conducting your investigation, and suddenly up pops a picture or several pictures that basically contain child porn in. And typically, you would report that straight away and say, this is what the computer contains, and you would prosecute on both. But this decision now appears to be that plain sight no longer applies to computer cases unless you have a warrant specifically for that. For both of those things, you have to stick with your original investigation. Now, I don't know whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, but what I can say is that I've had cases before that have been one thing and turned out to be something completely different. And I'm pretty sure that most people must have had that experience.
Yeah, I think this... I don't know if that's really quite what they're getting at with this. I think it's more a case of someone starting some kind of investigation and then saying, oh, let's see what else we can find, and throwing it all under the plain view rule. I think if you do find something that's outside the scope of your investigation and you do genuinely stumble across it, there'll be steps you can take to make sure that doesn't go unnoticed. I think there's a kind of middle ground that they've got to find with it, really.
Yeah. I think that it needs clarity, and it definitely needs some clarification, because what a lot of people are assuming right now is exactly what I said. You know, that you're conducting an investigation, you come across something else that needs to be reported because it's illegal, but you're almost restricted in what you're allowed to do there. Now, it's interesting to see how that works out, because if you've seen something... If, say, for example, this is the case. Say, you've seen something, like an indecent picture of a child on a computer, which it's not an indecent image case. What responsibility do you then have? Yeah, that's going to be very confusing to a lot of people, because if you don't report something when you know it to be illegal, you are, in essence, committing a crime yourself.
Well, you can deem as obstructing the course of justice, can't it?
Absolutely.
Applied in that way, and I hope it isn't applied in that way, because otherwise the only thing you could do is, as you notice that, it then falls on you to then report another criminal activity and hope a whole other investigation starts up, which is a bit of a crazy way of going about it, I suppose, but it depends on what people want to have come out of this, really.
Yeah. I think we'll definitely see a lot more of this story as things break, but like I said, there does seem to be a great deal of confusion in the field about what this does actually mean. And you've got to admit that it's exactly right. Who knows what the impact of this will eventually be? We'd have to keep our eyes open. I can't think of any other way around it, really.
Yep.
Right, so, so there's that, and there's also the entertainingly named CDFS has been formed over the last few weeks. The Digital Forensics Group have formed a council, several digital forensics groups have formed a council of digital forensic specialists, abbreviated to CDFS. And this, I think, is a fantastic idea. It's something that's needed to be done for quite some time. Now, what exactly is this council going to be responsible for, Simon?
Well, they're going to be responsible, essentially, for, amongst other things, kind of liaising with federal and other regulators to make sure that things like the forever mentioned PI law thing doesn't happen again.
Have we mentioned that before?
I think we might have touched on it maybe once or twice.
Oh, interesting. Mm. Okay, continue.
Yeah, they've essentially set five major goals: unite digital forensic specialists and industry-leading organisations, develop and compile an essential body of knowledge from existing resources, identify minimal qualification standards of practice, competencies and background requirements, create a model code of professional conduct, and, as I said, represent the profession to federal and state regulators and other bodies.
Very, very worthwhile goals there. Now, that's the mission of the CDFS. The CDFS basically comprises of seven different organisations. There's the Champlin College, I hope I've said that right, Champlin College Centre for Digital Investigation, the Computer Technology Investigators Network, the High Tech Crime Consortium, the International Society of Forensic Computer Examiners, yep, that's me, I'm CCE, Roger Williams University Centre for Forensics, Advanced Networking and Security, the SANS Institute, and Wisconsin Association of Computer Crime Investigators, West, as if that made any difference at all. That's fantastic. I mean, these are organisations which, especially like SANS and the ISFCE, where there's, they've got a lot of backing, these people, and I really honestly hope that they can do what they set out to do. And I'm certain that more people will join us as time goes on. But I'm just happy. That's fantastic. Like you said, the PI law stuff, that's been handled in a roundabout way by them already, where they've worked with the American Bar Association and hoped to legislate against us falling under PI laws. And I'm just hoping that they get involved in stuff like this last story and the other bits and pieces which have happened over the last few months, couple of years, really. I don't know what else to say about it. I just think it's very noble and it deserves some credit and our backing. So anything that we can do to help, especially with Rob Lee, who's been on the show previously and who, you know, is a good man. Let's get back, let's get behind him and back him on this and offer whatever support and help we can. I'm sure there's people all over the USA, and not just the USA, but also worldwide, who sees a benefit in something like this.
Yeah, I think so.
So, yeah. That's about all I've got, really. There are, obviously, there are some key people, or key organisations that are missing. The HTCIA, which I'm not entirely sure that doesn't come under the High Tech Crime Consortium, but if I made a mistake there, someone can correct me. But I really like some of these things on the mission. Like that point three you mentioned, identify minimal qualifications, standards of practice, competencies, and background requirements. That's fantastic, because we see so many people in this field who perhaps shouldn't know as much as they should do, or if you saw Twitter at all, with Mark McKinnon going on about something, then you can see that people ask questions about things that they should really have a fundamental understanding about before approaching an investigation. And I really honestly hope that they can push this forward. And I hope it doesn't just stop in the USA. I hope that other countries, like I said, around the world, take similar steps to this, because otherwise we're going to get snowballed by new laws which are going to come around, and, you know, stuff like the PI laws, stuff like don't use hacking tools, all that fun stuff. And we need to be ready and prepared to deal with people who start to push things like that as well. So, yeah. I think I ranted long enough about that.
Yeah, probably.
Are you still awake there?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, well, we'll move on to the interview now and give Simon some time to wake up. And when we come back, Simon's got an entertaining little story for us. Okay, today we're joined by Lee Reber of MFI. How are you doing, Lee?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
All right, not bad. I got the pronunciation of your name right this time, didn't I?
You know, that's, yes, Reber, and it's funny because people say Reiber. It should be Reiber, I believe, but, you know, of course, Americanizing a German name.
Yep. I made that mistake when I was talking about you a couple of weeks ago, and someone was very kind enough to correct me on it, so.
Okay.
Fair enough. Okay, well, for those people who don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, and how you got into the game to start with?
Well, again, I'm Lee Reber, and with Mobile Forensics Inc., or MFI, it's kind of an interesting story how I got into it. I'm processing cell phones and computers for the police department, and I started doing some training, and I wound up being in class with Carl Dunnigan down in Carlsbad, California, who was the owner or started MFI. He was a sheriff's officer down there, and we became good friends and attended more training in other venues, and he asked me to start instructing for him. And then he just got too busy being a superstar working in Hollywood as a technical advisor.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And so he was doing quite a few shows as a police technical advisor, and then said, hey, you know, I really can't stay in the game much anymore with cell phones. So, you know, would you like to buy the company? And
oh, wow.
Of course, I took him up on that, and here we are. You know, we're training pretty much primarily law enforcement and both state, local, and federal here in the U.S. on the extraction of cellular data. So it's been it's been quite a whirlwind. And now we actually are the training company for Access Data.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. So now we handle all of the mobile phone training for Access Data, as well as, of course, MFI.
Do Access Data have their own mobile phone forensic?
Yeah, they have a tool called MPE, and it's kind of just an extraction program, whereas then it brings it into FTK, where you can the data's parsed and you could manually go through and carve through the data. You can bring in additional file systems from other applications as well. And the funny thing about that, it's just bizarre, is we've always in the class since 2005, we've utilized FTK and brought in file systems from certain applications, BitPim being one of them, into FTK and used it to manually carve items. And now, look, we're handling the training for Access Data utilizing that tool as well. So
very cool.
It's quite funny.
Excellent stuff. All right, so what kind of stuff does the training involve that you offer at MFI then?
Well, we have a couple of offerings. We have our basic, or that we call it Mobile Forensics 101, where we deal with the logical tools. We are non-vendor specific, which means we will utilize all tools available to extract the maximum amount of data from the device. So, we'll use mobile edit, oxygen, device seizure, BitPim, and several other items to extract that data. And we learn the foundation of processing, really, and as we'll talk later about the MFCE, of bringing in the a forensic process to the extraction of this data and not relying on, say, a forensic tool. So that's where we build kind of a foundation. And then we have a Mobile Forensics 202 course where we actually use no automated tools. We manually extract data utilizing AT commands. We also utilize the FlasherBox to extract the raw data and actually manually parse the data that's contained in there, finding the dates and times in the files to validate software and to a lot of the times invalidate the dates and times that are listed by logical software. So there's quite a few offerings, and we're going to start doing online courses too, live online training. It'd be 1 day course, and we get specific with say a particular tool, a particular device, and we're going to be offering 10 of those. So that we can have a lot more interaction from around the world where people can just log on, process phones remotely. So that's going to be a really cool deal.
That's fantastic. So you talk about like the commercial type tools, like the ones which generate all the reports and everything for you. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the ones that you say like for the manual extraction. Have you got a preference of which one you would use during an investigation yourself?
As for logical tools, the commercial end,
well,
it's the ones that really that we utilize in the class, Cellebrite, and we do XRY, device seizure. It's hard to say in particular to one that is better than the other, because as you know, and I'm sure many of the listeners know, is a cell phone is a crazy animal. You might get SMS out of one using one piece of software and contacts using another. So there isn't really, I guess, the best tool. Our CDMA over here in the U.S., which we have quite a few CDMA phones,
yeah.
Open source BitPim is a fantastic tool to utilize and extract not just logical parse data, but the actual file system from the phone, where a lot of people don't think of deleted data could be because it's logical, but the phone actually caches some data onto in these files that is actually deleted and not on, say, the interface of the handset.
Well, I've got to be honest. I mean, I don't have a great deal of experience doing mobile phone handset examinations. Simon tends to be the one who does all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I've always, if I'm completely honest, right, I've always thought that there's so much in computers that that's where I want to be. But when I see that companies like yours are offering, you know, quite lengthy courses and a number of them to investigate mobile phones, am I wrong or am I missing something? I mean, are these things getting to be as complicated as, like, the desktop PC?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Just because, you know, so a desktop, we have, you know, we have our Mac, we have OS X, and then we have the PC, we're running Windows XP or Vista, hopefully not Vista, but, you know, now Windows 7. So you have, you know, maybe some guidelines, whereas we have a mobile phone. Boy, everything's proprietary. You have different types. You have your Windows Mobile 5 and 6. You know, obviously, we have Apple, our iPhone running kind of an OS 10. And then we have Brew. And then we have the different ways that it communicates, the different things in a file system, the different platforms. So I think that it is, in my mind, it's a pretty difficult thing to do. And it's funny seeing the not really funny, but the computer forensic examiner who has 20 plus years of examining a computer and is extremely, extremely good at what they do, have a cell phone and just be completely frustrated beyond belief because of the time involved to understand. We're really at the ground floor. There isn't a lot of understanding for the underlying architecture of files. And that's what we do in our training is we actually go – and because we have a logical tool says, okay, here's the phone book, or here's the, you know, here are all the contacts, and it displays it very nicely, you know, 600 contacts. Well, if you ask that examiner now, okay, where did that come from? They'll say, the phone? when they don't necessarily know the file that it resided in. And now what our training does is we want the examiners to know where that information came from. It's parsed out, great, fantastic, but where did that come from in that file system? So I think that, unfortunately, I wrote a paper called The Backward Approach to Mobile Forensics, and it really deals with that, where, you know, when we started our computer forensic exams, we really learned how the data was laid out, you know, the hardware, the platters, so we manually can locate the data. Was with mobile phones, we really started out with here's the button that you push and here's the stuff that comes out. So now we're kind of playing catch up and now we're trying to understand how the information is laid out, where it is that these tools carve out. So it's frustrating, especially training at some, you know, sometimes because people just want it now. And that's what I call the four letter word is it's time. Because that it takes a while, if you want to do things correctly, and unfortunately we're in a time crunch, really. You know, when we have the backlog of computers or of cell phones to examine.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things which we talk about quite frequently is a convergence of like computer and phone examinations. Do you see that the line blurring quite a lot now between phones and computers in terms of how we should be looking at them, how we do examine them, and the kind of data that resides on them?
Well, the data is data, I guess we want to say. Yeah. The examination nowadays, say for a computer and a cell phone, are completely different. Are completely different, and it's not necessarily because of the lack of training or knowledge. It has to do with, say, computers. We're dealing with a static device. Well, for the most part, obviously, we won't talk about live systems, but say you have a hard drive, and you control, really, that static environment. Whereas when you're dealing with cell phones, you know, obviously, it's an active device. There's steps that you have to take to, say, isolate it from the network, obviously, if it's on. And because things could obviously change, whereas a hard drive, hey, you have a write blocker, you hook it up. With a cell phone, there is no write blocker because the software that you utilize to communicate with it, obviously, if it communicates at a modem level, it's going to write through any type of write blocker that you put in between it.
Yeah.
So I think that really the I would love to see the forensic approach, and that's what we're teaching, of a cell phone examination to the extent that a computer exam, and follow those same guidelines, because eventually it's going to catch up to us in the court system.
Yeah. Where do you see, like, mobile phone examinations being, like, in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, and so on?
Well, hopefully, I see them as more of a methodology instead of push button forensics.
Yeah.
I'd like to call it. I see them being more extensive because I see obviously the availability now of our Windows platforms. Obviously of the Mac platforms, and now obviously Google's taking over the world. Anyway, so we have the Android. And, I think that we're going to be running into more and more of those. And if we don't take a forensic approach, we're going to be hurting.
Now, going back a few episodes, it, very, very early on, we reported about the MFCE. And we'd barely pushed the podcast episode out when you sent me an email saying, well, actually, you're not entirely correct about what you're saying. And in the nicest way possible, I have to say that. But I want to hear more about this now, because I don't mind being wrong at all. I've got to be completely honest. It's the way I learn things. And if I screw something up, that's fair enough. And I want to apologize, first of all, for getting it wrong.
But, no, that's a, hey, we all learn things. If you say you're not learning anything, then you're dead. So you always want to be learning something, and that's usually how it works for me too. Is I'm usually wrong. That's how I learn, obviously, when I do that. But with the MFCE. Really what kind of brought that about is, again, just kind of what we've been talking about, is that there's really – it's kind of – let's just get the stuff now and not worry about the really what happens. So what we wanted to do is bring in a process to kind of validate what we're doing. So the MFCE is based on 6 problems. And they could be from SOPs or standard operating procedures that one might have. It goes to, hey, here's a phone that's actually locked. How do you unlock it? Here's a physical file system or a permanent memory file from a Nokia handset. Now, tell me where this data is located. Also, another problem could be, okay, you get a handset into your lab and there is no SIM card contained in there. What do you do? What steps do you go through? Do you create a forensic SIM clone? Well, how do you do that if you only have this information? Can you still extract data without a SIM card? So what we try to do is take 6 problems that you would run into in your lab. Now, there isn't one piece of software that we recommend, because this is, again, we want to be real-world scenarios. So we allow the examiners to use whatever software they have available to them. And we are going to obviously make a problem that they will not be able to solve unless they have one piece of software. All of these problems, they can work through with what they have in their current lab, obviously if they do have some processing equipment. To the final problem, where you actually receive live media, which means that the phone is attached to a cellular network, and if you do not follow the correct procedures and isolate the phone, you could then receive a message from me saying, you better call me because you just failed. So that's the bad thing to do. So you want to make sure that you follow those procedures, and then of course there is a written exam at the bringing kind of the whole the whole process together. It is a 6-month process. Well, we do give 6 months to complete it. It's from what I've heard, after, you know, people are obviously upset at me for being so mean to them, I guess, during the process. No, I'm not. They refer to it as another class in itself, almost like a 404 class, MFI 404, where they learn more during this process of these six exams than, you know, all the classes they've attended together. So I see that as probably the best thing. Obviously, we use it as a learning process because they do have coaches that don't give them the answers, but obviously help them along the way, or kind of the journey, which is, it's, again, real world. We kind of modeled it a little bit after the CFCE with the problems itself. I like to say it's a lot more difficult.
it sounds it. I mean, considering you're giving 6 months for these things and handing out live media and the like, you obviously taking this extremely seriously. This isn't just, a normal certification, is it?
No. And that's, I wanted it to have some teeth. We've had people fail. Now, obviously, we don't like to see that, but it has to be valid. It has to be something that if they called me, if someone was, say, that's an MFC and they go to court, and if someone was challenging the validity of that certification, and called me to explain it, I want obviously the people to do just like you are going, you have got to be kidding me. You make them do 6 months worth of this training or going through this class. And of course, I mean, you want it to be valid.
Yeah. So how did the whole concept come about then? Was this something that you'd always had in mind, that you wanted to create a certification specifically for mobile devices, or was it something which other people suggested to you and you decided it'd be a good idea?
Yeah, we had during the classes, when we would teach, we had, lots of people would just go, well, I go to this certification, and it's a day class, and I receive a certification. I just don't feel real comfortable with that. They would say to us, and they'd say, hey, why don't you come up with something? And that's the same thing as people, well, why don't you write a book? I'm going, well, yeah, okay. It'll hire someone to do that. But, it really came out of a need or maybe a frustration that I had of the way things are being done. I get on my soapbox once in a while, and I become frustrated at certain things of how things are working out. And if I just don't want to be the one that would have to, explain why now there's, say, a Supreme Court decision in the U.S. That we now as examiners have to follow, a certain rule now. We might as well get to kind of the head start and come up with guidelines before we're told what we need to do.
Yeah. So that's really cool. So obviously the length of time and the involvement of live media and everything else, that's this is why I think I incorrectly made assumptions about the whole certification previously, because I wasn't aware of the process. Now, originally you had said that you were going to allow 100 people or so to do the certification.
Right, that we were going to start that. And we're still doing it quarterly now. Obviously, what we'd like to do, once people are receive the certification, what we'd like to ask them to do is to help, obviously train others to be a coach if it works out that way, because then we could just continue to grow this. What I'd really like to see this just kind of leave any type of control with MFI, and I would like it to become its own, so that it grows and it's really not attached to sort of a stigma, I guess, of it's MFI, so it's MFI certification. I would really love to push this into an area where someone else is, or a group or board is managing this, because, you know, obviously that would be also valid, or make it more valid in some people's eyes.
Do you mean like a private company taking control, or do you mean something more government-backed?
Well, we'd love to have it government-backed, but I would like to see examiners backed, you know, even if it's a nonprofit organization that's started, where the money that's say for the testing to go through that is obviously brought into the company to pay for the shipping. That's pretty much what it covers now, you know, the shipping of the phones, the to have the live phones, things like that. I would just like, I don't want to say it like IASIS, but like a company that is not making money on it, but it's made up of examiners from all over, federal, state, local, you know, private industry, from all over the world.
That's cool. Something that we have here in England, we have an organization called F3, mm-hmm. It's First Forensic Forum. I don't know if you've heard of it before, but essentially all the digital forensic companies and police forces and everything have something to do with this organization. Would that be something that you think you could be replicated over there?
Oh, you bet. That would be fantastic, obviously, to have certain repositories, obviously, for, you know, local phones or local examiners, things that can make this grow. And then obviously we all get together in a certain location and discuss it. You bet.
Yep. Fantastic. Well, I hope that all works out for you. Now, if somebody was to say, you know, I'd like to take, I'd like to challenge this, or take the challenge up, so to speak, and go for the mobile forensic certified examiner, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, there's a website. It's www.mfce.us. On there, you can just hit the registration button and complete that. You'll be then contacted. Again, it's quarterly. The next one is going to start here in a few weeks, and then you're kind of put in queue, obviously.
Yep.
And then contacted to start the process.
Very cool. And like you said before, you're offered somebody to help you and assist you if you run into some kind of difficulty with it. To what extent will they offer you help, or to what extent will they leave it up to you to figure it out?
Oh, no, you are you're assigned a coach. And what that coach does is you submit, say, your reports. Once you're completed with that, your exam or whatever problem, you submit your report to them. And the coach either says, hey, fantastic job. Or obviously says, hey, you know what, let's maybe work on this area, or you might need to look in this portion of the phone, you know, kind of give you some pointers and some ideas. Obviously, you know, we don't want them to give them the answers and to the problems. And that's why we kind of screen. And if someone hasn't been to basic class or an advanced class, they have to complete an initial pretest, obviously, to see kind of where they stand. Because we don't want people to get into the situation and just fail out of it. Because again, then you run into the problem of, hey, you're just taking their money.
Yeah. No, that's understandable.
Right.
The last thing you want is people harassing you for things.
Exactly. So, yeah. So, you know, the coaches are always there to help out.
Very cool. And then, assuming someone is successful, like I said before, they can go through. And you say before that they kind of get involved with the coaching themselves for other people who are taking the tests?
They get a huge, pretty certificate with a big stamp on it. Says they're excellent. But no, that's really what we want them to do, is kind of give back. Because to be honest with you, when I'm training or doing or coaching people through this, you learn more as an instructor than, you know, I'm sure that they are learning. So it only makes you a better examiner if you're assisting others. So I think that that's probably the I guess the most beneficial thing to coaching.
I completely agree. Mm-hmm. There's times when we're doing training at work or something like that, and someone will ask a question, and you think, I've never, ever thought of that before. Why have I never? That's so obvious.
You're exactly right. That is, you know, and if you start saying, oh, yeah, I know everything, and not listening to people, then you're in trouble. But, yeah, I completely agree with that. It's always someone looks at it in a different way, and you're like, wow, I never thought of that. And you're exactly right. Now, of course, you steal their idea. Very cool.
So, how many people do you take on? You say it's quarterly. How many people would be in the queue for doing it?
We won't do more than 20.
Okay.
Yeah, and that becomes overwhelming for everyone. Especially if you don't want it again to just become, oh, I got to get on to the next one here. Yeah, you passed. You know, so you want it to be beneficial to them. So we don't want to take any on anything that we can't manage.
Excellent. So you got an overlap of 60 then, haven't you? If you,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's got to be a lot of work on top of your.
Exactly. That's why. Please. We need coaches.
Very cool. All right. Well, if people want to find you, where can they do that online at?
Yeah, they also we are at www.mobileforensicsinc.com, all one word. Or also you can go to mfi-training.com. That'll jump you to the main page. And also we have a forum where you can register. It's at forum.mobileforensicsinc.com. And on there it has a great repository of phones that have been processed by examiners that you can go on to and see what they utilize to extract the data. And it's also a live database where if a phone isn't on there that you're processing, you can add it yourself. And then you're kind of helping out the next examiner if he looks for that phone. And also on there it has obviously a communication board for examiners.
Excellent. So I didn't know about the forum before. So there's a forum for each specific type of phone, or something in each forum for a specific type of phone?
Well, no, actually on the forum it has, and it talks, yeah, we do break up in GSM, CDMA, those types, but on the actual database, if you click the database function, it will then come up with a searchable field where you can actually look for the specific device.
Okay.
On there. Mm-hmm.
Good. All right. Well, are you found on Twitter or anything like that as well?
Yeah, I am. I am on Twitter. It's MFI. Actually, what is it? Capital MFI Training on Twitter there. And there's a link directly on the mobilefriendsinc.com where you can join or look me up on there.
Excellent stuff. All right. Have you got anything coming up in the future, any plans or ideas that you formulate that you could share with us?
Oh, yeah. Actually, we'll head it off to Washington, D.C. next week for a few days and going to train at our Department of Homeland Security there. And then we are starting kind of a pilot program with IRS Cyber in training to conduct all of our training on VM. So we're going to be discussing utilizing just VM for the processing of these devices because, obviously if there's driver issues, there's communication between different types of software. So we're going to learn to build all these VMs for specific software.
Excellent. So, that sounds very impressive.
That's fun.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us for the interview. Today.
Anytime. Really anytime. Thanks for having me.
And we'll likely have you back another time.
Perfect. We can always do that.
Cool stuff. All right. Well, thanks again, and we'll talk later.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
And welcome back. Simon.
Yes.
Have you got a fun little story to share with us this week?
Okay, yes, I do. If you were so inclined as to head down the route of criminal activity and decide to rob somewhere, you'd think of all the things you could leave behind and you would generally try and come try and plan for that and make sure that nothing that could be traced back to you would be left behind. I guess you'd think about making sure you don't leave footprints, fingerprints, things like that, DNA anywhere. What one guide didn't really think about was for some reason he had his dog with him and managed to leave his dog behind when he was Wimbled. According to an article in the Daily Telegraph, a man who broke into a primary school in Gateshead, I guess he set off an alarm, got spooked, he ran off without taking anything, but left his dog behind.
Poor dog.
Yeah. So this dog's now in the care of the Northumbria Police. They've given him a name and a temporary home, and they're trying to track down the owner. So I think that's kind of interesting.
What they need to do is they need to take this guy's computer and have a look at it and see if his dog's actually been entering any pornographic search terms on his computer.
Or dialing emergency services or...
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's mostly cats that do things like that, though.
Cats are evil, Simon. Cats are evil. Dogs are a man's best friend.
Yeah.
Though it won't be for very much longer if he gets ditched in the school.
Not this man's best friend, by the looks of it.
Fun stuff. All right, well, we'll be back again in a couple of weeks' time. And hopefully with our big announcement. So stay listening, stay watching the skies, and... Yeah, I think I'll stop there.
Yeah.
Talk to you later. Bye for now.
Bye.